Imagine you're standing in this fantastic little deli in Assisi, Italy.
Oh, nice. Great spot for a story.
Right. The atmosphere is perfect. You're just hanging out, chatting, and your friend Christina is up at the counter paying the bill.
Yeah.
But then, out of nowhere, right in the middle of this totally normal, everyday moment, she turns to you, looks right at your smart glasses, and points out just a glaring ethical flaw in the whole tech ecosystem. She just says, "Surely you can't just record other people and call it private software."
I mean, it's the kind of casually profound statement that really just stops you in your tracks because, well, she's entirely correct.
Exactly.
She somehow managed to cut straight through all the marketing hype, to expose this massive structural problem that the tech industry has been trying so hard to ignore.
And that deli conversation, that's actually the exact grounding point for today's deep dive. We're exploring this fascinating manifesto published back on April 20th, 2026, by a developer named Vlad Cielecu.
Right, for the local ghost.a project.
Yes, exactly. It's titled, "What the Ghost Owes the People It Overhears." And our mission today is to really dig into this wild tension for you listening. Because, like, the tech industry is obsessed with giving you this perfect digital memory wearable, but in the process, they're accidentally turning you into a walking, talking surveillance state.
Which brings us to the central thesis of the manifesto. It argues quite convincingly, I think, that a memory device for one person is inherently a surveillance system for everyone else.
Wow. Yeah. Put it like that, it's chilling.
Right. Think about it. If you are recording your entire day just to remember your own life, you are simultaneously capturing the private lives of every single stranger, barista, and coworker you happen to cross paths with.
So what does this all mean?
Yeah.
To figure out how one developer is trying to fix this, we first need to understand how the tech giants got it so wrong. I mean, they built these devices on the assumption that the only privacy that matters is, the privacy of the person wearing the hardware.
Yeah, and that blind spot has created an absolute graveyard of failed wearables over the last year. 2025 was just brutal for that specific business
Oh,
model.
completely.
Look at Humane's Apin. That was that chest-worn device with a camera and a mic actively pointing at whoever was standing in front of you.
Right, and they collapsed early in 2025.
Yeah, sold all their patents off to HP. Then you had Rewind. Their whole pitch was recording literally everything you saw and heard. They started as a desktop app, pivoted to a physical pendant around your neck, and eventually just got absorbed by Meta in, I think, December 2025.
I remember that pivot. They actually killed off their desktop app and cut off service to the EU and the UK entirely right before that Meta acquisition.
Yep.
And we can't forget B. That was that ambient wristband only cost like $50, and it just listened to everything within earshot to auto-generate to-do lists.
Oh, yeah, Amazon swallowed them up in July 2025.
Honestly, looking at the landscape, the only AI recording wearable really still shipping in high volumes right now is Plaid. And that's exclusively because they use a physical manual button you have to press to record.
Right, they completely sidestepped the whole continuous ambient capture problem.
Exactly.
And we really have to look at how those ambient companies tried to handle the issue of recording innocent bystanders before they folded. Because their solution was, well, it was essentially a lazy legal shrug.
A shrug. How so?
They just buried a clause in their terms of service that pushed all the legal liability onto you, the user, and then shipped the hardware anyway.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah. The only reason they didn't face massive regulatory crackdowns is that none of those wearables reached ubiquity. The user base was just too small for a privacy regulator or like a class action lawyer to care.
But the manifesto gives us this perfect cautionary tale of what actually happens when ambient recording tech reaches massive scale. We just have to look at the Amazon Ring doorbell. I
Huh?
mean, it's sitting on roughly 10 million American homes.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, scale always invites scrutiny. Always. In May 2023, the FTC hit Amazon with a $5.8 million fine over Ring, and the details of how they handled that ambient data were just shocking.
Yeah, I remember reading about this.
Amazon was allowing its employees and even third-party contractors based in Ukraine to freely browse customer videos. And we aren't just talking about front porches. These were cameras placed inside bedrooms and bathrooms.
Wait, why were contractors in Ukraine watching bedroom footage? That's insane.
To train their AI image recognition models, human labelers had to watch the raw video to teach the software what it was looking at, and Amazon did this without explicitly asking for user consent. On top of that, Ring completely ignored security warnings about credential stuffing attacks.
Okay, just to clarify for you listening, credential stuffing is when hackers take leaked passwords from one website and just automate testing them across thousands of other accounts.
Exactly. And Ring didn't implement basic protections against that, which led to more than 55,000 U.S. user accounts being compromised. Bad actors could literally just log in and watch live feeds inside people's homes.
Oh, my God. And we haven't even touched on their police partnerships yet. Ring partnered with over 500 U.S. police departments, creating this massive privatized surveillance network.
Yeah, it was everywhere.
It took years of intense pressure from organizations like the EFF and the ACLU to force Ring to finally shut down its request for assistance portal, and that was in January 2024. And the kicker, Amazon just quietly reopened that same pipeline for law enforcement through partnerships with Axon and Flock in mid-2025.
Yep, they found a workaround.
But, you know, I have to challenge the Manifesto's comparison here. Wait, comparing a doorbell camera to a wearable AI pin feels like comparing a security guard to a personal assistant, right?
Yeah.
You know the doorbell is there. It's on a building. You can avoid it. A wearable is like a hidden drone following you around. You have no idea when you're being recorded. Mm-hmm. So why would a personal wearable invite the same kind of regulatory wrath as a home security system once it scales?
Because of that exact difference you just highlighted, roaming ubiquity.
Roaming ubiquity.
Right. A fixed camera only monitors its specific field of view. An ambient wearable walks into cafes, office meetings, public restrooms, subway cars. Right now, nobody is prosecuting a single person wearing an AI pin because there simply aren't enough of them to cause systemic harm.
Right. It's just rare.
But the moment 10 million people are wearing hidden microphones, that enforcement gap closes. The regulatory response won't just be identical to Ring. It will be significantly harsher because the surveillance is invisible and it's mobile.
Which perfectly explains why building this tech isn't just about, like, avoiding a regulatory fine in the U.S. In some parts of the world, building this tech actually gets you sent to prison.
Yes.
We're moving from the theoretical threat of scale in America to the absolute existing legal reality in Europe. And the manifesto lays out why capturing audio is fundamentally treated as a worse offense than capturing video.
And the distinction between audio and video in European law is vital here. Under the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, video captured in public spaces has a household exemption.
Okay, meaning what?
Meaning if you're filming your kid's birthday party in a park for personal use, you're fine. But in 2014, a landmark ruling known as the Ryan case narrowed that exemption. Oh. The court decided that if you point a security camera outward, capturing a public space like a street, you instantly become a data controller.
And being a data controller isn't just a fancy title, is it? It comes with a massive regulatory burden.
Immense burden. Suddenly, you legally need visible signage warning people they are being recorded. You need a legally defensible purpose for the recording, and you have to respond to data deletion requests from total strangers.
Wow.
Yeah, if a person walks past your house, they have the right to demand you delete that footage.
But with audio, you don't even get that household exemption to start with, right?
Right.
Why is European law so much more aggressive about microphones?
Well, think about the nature of the capture. You can see a camera, you can look away, put up an umbrella, walk on the other side of the street.
Right, you can avoid it.
Exactly. But a hidden microphone captures your inner thoughts, your intimate conversations, your business negotiations, completely invisibly. You can't stop your voice from carrying. Because of that, in countries like Germany, France, Italy, Spain, Austria, and Romania, recording private speech isn't handled as a data privacy issue. It is a criminal statute.
This is where the stakes just get incredibly high. Germany's criminal code, specifically Section 201, carries a penalty of up to 3 years in prison for recording the non-publicly spoken word without consent.
3 years.
And non-public doesn't mean you have to be in a locked room. It includes a private conversation you're having at a table in a public cafe.
Right.
France's Article 226, Attach 1 is similarly severe, carrying up to a year in prison and a 45,000 euro fine.
Now, contrast that strict approach with the UK or the Netherlands. Those countries have one-party consent exceptions.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, as long as you are actively participating in the conversation, you are legally allowed to record it without telling the other person. But in most of continental Europe, all-party consent is the absolute baseline. And here is the mechanism that breaks most tech companies' promises: the criminal offense is completed at the precise moment of capture.
Okay, let's unpack this for you listening, because this is really the hinge of the whole legal problem. This isn't a parking ticket or a terms of service violation. The very millisecond that microphone turns on and digitizes a stranger's voice, the law has been broken.
Exactly.
Even if your software promises to delete that audio an hour later or a minute later, you have still committed a criminal act. Deletion does not retroactively cure the offense.
Right, and this raises an important question that you're probably wondering about right now. If these laws are so draconian, how on earth are workplace tools operating?
Yes, I'm a bit confused here. Millions of people use tools like Zoom, Microsoft Teams, Otter, Fireflies every single day.
Oh, constantly.
They're constantly recording meetings to generate action items and summaries. So are you saying every company in Europe is currently risking a criminal lawsuit?
No, but they are surviving because of institutional power. Corporate entities have built-in legal shields that an individual person just doesn't possess.
Ah, I see.
But getting those workplace tools approved in Europe was an absolute bloodbath. Take Germany, for instance. There's a labor law called the Works Constitution Act, specifically Section 87. It essentially acts as a giant red stop button for corporate surveillance.
Okay.
German works councils use Section 87 to force companies into co-determination, meaning management couldn't deploy AI transcription without the workers' explicit agreement.
And the courts backed the workers up.
They absolutely did. In July 2024, the Federal Labor Court ruled that any technology even capable of monitoring employee behavior triggers this right to veto.
Wow.
Yeah. And similarly, the French Data Protection Authority, the CNIL, aggressively pushed organizations to justify why they needed to retain full audio recordings instead of just written summaries. The pressure was so intense that Microsoft was actually forced to change how Teams operates in 2023.
Really? How so?
They had to ship a feature requiring explicit consent. Meaning, if a meeting recording starts, your microphone is forcibly muted by the software until you physically press 1 on your dial pad to opt in.
Man, it sounds like the only thing that really survived this regulatory gauntlet unscathed is the summary-only tool. Like, the manifesto points to an app called Granola as the gold standard for this.
Yes, Granola is a great example.
It's a desktop app that transcribes your meeting locally, right there on your laptop, generates a structured text summary, and then permanently throws away the raw audio file.
And Granola works brilliantly in a corporate environment. But if an individual user tries to do the exact same thing in public, they run into a wall.
Why, though? If Granola figured out how to do this legally by deleting the audio, why can't a solo user with a wearable pin just use the same process?
Because of that institutional shield we talked about. If a Microsoft Teams recording accidentally captures something sensitive or someone complains, there is a massive corporate legal team, a dedicated data protection officer, and complex indemnity clauses all ready to handle the fallout. A solo user sitting in that cafe in Milan has none of that infrastructure. They won't even know they've violated Section 201 of the German Criminal Code until the police are asking questions. For a personal device to survive legally, the technical architecture itself has to carry the entire load of a corporate legal department.
And that leads us to the engineering genius of the local ghost manifesto. Vlad Sielku argues that since you don't have a corporate lawyer in your pocket, the code itself has to enforce the law.
Exactly.
He proposes a rigorous four-stage design to achieve this. Stage one, your phone captures the audio in tiny encrypted chunks and immediately forwards them away from the device to your NAS.
Right. And for those unfamiliar, a NAS stands for Network Attached Storage.
Right.
It's basically a private physical hard drive that you own sitting on a desk in your living room. It is completely disconnected from big tech's cloud infrastructure.
Okay, got it. And then stage two is where the magic happens. The NAS receives those encrypted chunks and consumes them into a RAM ring buffer.
Yes, and this mechanism is the core of the privacy defense. A RAM ring buffer holds the audio in the system's temporary memory for just a few seconds to a few minutes. It is constantly overwriting the oldest data as new audio comes in.
So it's never permanent.
Exactly. The crucial point here is that the unencrypted audio never, ever lands on a physical disk. It exists fleetingly in temporary memory.
I love this concept. To visualize how a RAM ring buffer works, it's kind of like having an incredibly skilled interpreter standing next to you.
Yeah.
They listen to a stranger speaking, instantly whisper a translated summary into your ear, and then immediately forget the original words. No tape recording is ever made.
That analogy is spot on. It captures the ephemerality perfectly, but the manifesto layers on intense technical rigor to make sure that analogy holds up in court.
Right, because courts don't run on analogies.
Exactly. That brings us to stage three. A program called Ghost.Voiced transcribes the audio while it's in that temporary memory and attaches context, things like the time of day, your GPS location, and the roles of the people speaking. And finally, stage four. A program called GhostDot Noted takes that transcription and turns it into a journal entry, specifically rewritten into the user's own voice.
But the manifesto points out a huge hurdle here, doesn't it? Your smartphone is actually a deeply hostile environment for trying to maintain privacy.
Oh, extremely hostile. Operating systems like Apple's iOS and Google's Android are designed to aggressively back up absolutely everything on your phone to the cloud. If you are trying to keep audio ephemeral, an automatic iCloud backup is your worst enemy.
So how does LocalGhost survive that?
Well, to get around it, those tiny encrypted audio chunks have to be carefully placed in specific directories that are explicitly excluded from cloud backups. And the moment your home NAS server confirms it has received the chunk, the phone's copy must be mathematically destroyed.
Mathematically destroyed, meaning what exactly? Like formatting the drive?
No, meaning the software instantly deletes the encryption key. Without the key, the audio file is instantly turned into unreadable, irreversible digital garbage forever.
Which brings us to the ultimate unforgiving test for this entire architecture. The author proposes a forensic test. Could a legal examiner, looking at your hardware tomorrow, reconstruct the conversation you overheard yesterday?
And if the answer is yes, or even maybe, then your privacy claim is just marketing. The stakes are absolute. If any hidden backup layer retains a raw buffer, or if the language model's memory of the conversation somehow outlives the session, the promise breaks and you are exposed to criminal liability.
You can't just trust the user to delete it.
Right. You cannot rely on the user having the discipline to delete files. Airtight, self-destructing architecture is the only real defense.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. This strict architectural deletion isn't just a clever legal loophole to avoid European prison time. It actually perfectly mirrors how human biology works.
Yes.
It completely inverts the tech industry's entire philosophy of what a memory wearable should be.
Exactly. I mean, look at the original pitch from companies like Rewind. They promised perfect recall, the idea that every single word you've ever heard is preserved verbatim and becomes searchable text.
Right. Every single word.
But the manifesto exposes the fundamental absurdity of this approach. If you record a week of verbatim conversations, it takes exactly 1 week to listen to them.
True.
A raw transcript doesn't actually help you answer practical human questions like, what final decision did we make, or what surprised you about that meeting?
And the manifesto gives this brilliant real-world example to illustrate the difference. The LocalGhost system doesn't save an audio file of a hotel receptionist. Instead, it saves a highly structured journal entry that reads, at Hotel Duomo, I asked the receptionist about late check-in. She agreed to 1400.
Specificity is the rule.
Exactly. It grabs real times, named places, and specific roles. That summary is what actually remains useful months later.
And this reveals a profound psychological insight about us. Human memory is naturally built around the shape and the meaning of a conversation, not a verbatim transcript.
Totally.
A truly smart device should learn what you noticed and what mattered to you, rather than blindly hoarding what everyone else said. It should treat the other people in the room merely as context for your own reasoning.
And that biological mirroring leads to the ultimate legal trick. Because the only text that survives this process is your personal account of what happened, there is literally no other people's data left for GDPR or those European criminal statutes to protect.
It's brilliant.
You aren't storing the receptionist's voice. You are storing your own memory of the agreement. It's so liberating to realize that our own imperfect, summary-based memory is actually a feature, not a bug. And AI should be mimicking that, not acting like a creepy court reporter following you around.
It is a brilliant legal workaround. However, the author is intellectually honest enough to admit that architecture alone can't solve every problem.
Right, life is messy.
Yeah, there are real-world situations where the mere presence of a microphone creates friction, regardless of how quickly the RAM buffer deletes the data.
Right.
We have to go back to Christina in the deli. What happens if someone looks at your device and explicitly asks, am I being recorded?
Exactly.
The architecture gives you zero cover in that social interaction.
Right.
If you say yes, which means Christina's casual observation becomes a mandatory hardware policy. The device absolutely needs a visible, physical indicator that it's active, and it needs a physical gesture, like tapping it, to instantly stop capture.
And then you have highly sensitive contexts. Think about walking into a meeting with your doctor, your lawyer, a therapist, or, you know, if you're a journalist, meeting a confidential source.
Yeah, you can't be recording that.
Right. The Ghost software running on your NAS can't make nuanced ethical judgment calls in the heat of the moment. It requires architecture-level exclusions to protect those spaces. The manifesto suggests things like keyword triggers in your digital calendar or GPS boundaries geofenced around hospitals that force the device to default to no capture.
Wait, I have to push back on the calendar idea. What if I just walk into a doctor's office without putting it in my Apple calendar?
Good point.
I mean, if I don't meticulously manage my digital schedule, the device keeps recording. That means the burden of privacy still falls entirely on my own human memory to remember to turn the machine off.
That is the friction of real-world implementation. You're exactly right. If the technical triggers fail, the human has to intervene. Another massive point of friction is border crossings.
Oh, because the laws change.
Yes, because laws vary so wildly, like Romania having stricter criminal codes than travelers might expect, the device has to use your phone's GPS to trigger a roaming alert for privacy laws. Just like your cell provider texts you about data rates when you land in a new country, your memory device needs to alert you to the local legal reality before it records another session.
It's a logistical nightmare.
It is. What's fascinating here is that the author realizes that even if you perfectly solve the legal question with RAM buffers and you solve the logistical questions with GPS alerts, the ethical question completely survive.
Right, because of perception.
Exactly. People are still being perceived and processed by a computational system they did not opt into. Therefore, the manifesto establishes three absolute baseline commitments that any ethical device must meet.
Let's run through those for the listener.
First is ephemerality, meaning the raw moment must never outlive itself. Second is anonymity, meaning if a synthesized moment does persist, it never identifies the speaker by name unless absolutely necessary. And third is restraint, keeping only the data that is strictly needed to aid the user's memory and nothing more.
Right.
These three commitments represent the absolute baseline floor for an ethical wearable.
To summarize this incredible journey for you listening, we started with the tech industry's flawed assumption that a personal AI memory device meant hoarding recordings of everything and everyone around you. But we've discovered that true innovation actually lies in building a system that forces the machine to forget almost immediately.
Exactly.
The goal isn't to build a personalized digital surveillance state, it's to create an augmented personal diary.
And if you take nothing else away from this deep dive, remember the forensic test. If you were ever tempted to invest in one of these AI memory wearables, ask yourself if a lawyer or friend or forensic examiner sees this hardware tomorrow, could they reconstruct the conversation I overheard yesterday?
Wow.
If they can, that company's privacy policy is nothing but marketing.
It really makes you rethink our entire relationship with technology and memory. And, you know, the manifesto leaves us with one incredibly provocative final thought to mull over. It proves that to legally and ethically protect privacy, an AI memory device must treat the other people in your life simply as background context for your personal story.
Right.
The system never lets them become the subject of their own narrative. But if we outsource our memory to machines that are literally programmed to exclusively prioritize our own perspective, what happens to our capacity for empathy? Do we risk crapping ourselves in a perfectly curated echo chamber of our own digital memories, forgetting that the people around us, like Christina at the deli counter in Assisi, have their own stories too?